This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm Zach Weissmuller. Today I'm talking with Michael Solana, a vice president of Founders Fund, which is a venture capital firm worth upwards of $3 billion, founded by Peter Thiel, PayPal co-founder Luke Nosek, former PayPal CFO Ken Howery, and Sean Parker of Napster and Facebook fame. Some of the fund's investments include SpaceX, Airbnb, Lyft, and Oculus, as well as a variety of lesser-known companies in the realms of aerospace, biotechnology, energy, and internet technology. I wanted to talk to Michael about the future. It's something he thinks about a lot. In fact, he hosts his own podcast for Founders Fund called Anatomy of Next, the latest season of which explores the ways in which emerging technologies will get humanity to Mars and beyond. But Michael and his colleagues also believe that Silicon Valley is stuck, mired in groupthink and susceptible to the false promises of socialism. In this conversation, we talk about what Founders Fund is doing differently, why he believes capitalism is necessarily the engine of growth and innovation, the perils and promises of privatizing government functions, and what he's learned from the famously contrarian Peter Thiel about what it means to be a truly independent thinker. I hope you enjoy my talk with Michael Solana.
Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And I want to ask you first just about your journey. How did you get involved with Founders Fund? My understanding is that there might be some sort of Reason connection, and also that it was you went via the seasteading route. So could you just take us through that?
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. I used to be an editor. I was an editor of nonfiction at Penguin Books in my early 20s. I was 23. I just moved to New York City. And I was at my most anarcho-capitalist, definitely a libertarian, definitely reading Reason all of the time. And just kind of like really loved your blog. You had a, I forget what you called it back then, Hit and Run. Is it still up?
It still is. Yep. Still is Hit and Run. So, and you were about what age at this time?
I was 23.
Okay.
And you guys, this was 10 years ago, you wrote just a brief little post on seasteading, I believe. You linked to an article of Peter's. He had just written a piece in which he talked about seasteading. He talked a lot about the frontier, the space frontier. And that's what immediately piqued my interest, because that's always been, since I was a kid, that's been the thing that I was, I think, most interested in for us as a species, was getting into space, colonizing new worlds and things like that. But in it, he made this case for the necessity of frontiers. And he talked a lot about, this is Peter Thiel. So he talked a lot about, the space frontier is a ways off, but we don't have a frontier right now and we need it for cultural reasons as well as economic reasons and scientific and technological reasons. So he kind of introduced the concept of seasteading. So this idea that you'd build a bunch of politically autonomous cities in the middle of the ocean and people could kind of just opt in to whatever they wanted to in terms of government. I thought that was really cool. I wanted to meet a bunch of anarcho-capitalists who wanted to build floating cities in the middle of the ocean. So I reached out to the Seasteading Institute and I was like, hey, I'll just work for you for free. If you want me to write, I can write. I'm a writer. I'd love to write your Wikipedia page. And they were like, yes. They wrote back almost immediately. It was Patrick Friedman. He wrote back and he was like, yes, I want that. And also, because they were based in San Francisco, they were like, can you throw some meetup groups for us in New York City? So I did. And I met Peter at the very first one. And we kind of just talked. We just like talked all night about politics and philosophy, just kind of seasteading stuff, like anarcho-capitalism type stuff. Just got to know each other and became kind of friends. And then I don't know. I never thought I'd really have. I didn't even know what a venture capitalist was back then, honestly. I was interested in technology because I was interested in science fiction and Star Trek. I wrote science fiction, but I had no real sense of the tech industry. And back then, 10 years ago, that was actually possible in New York. Like, there were people who just didn't know anything about the tech industry. It had not quite dominated our culture the way it does today. And I don't know, a couple years in, he just wanted me to move out to San Francisco and work with him on a few projects. One of them, his class at Stanford that he taught called CS183, which went on to become his book, Zero to One. So I worked on kind of distilling all of his ideas and producing structure to them. I named a lot of those chapters in that book. All of the pop cultural references are mine. Lady Gaga was definitely me. But also
very interesting book, by the way. I recommend it to anyone who has any entrepreneurial inclinations whatsoever.
Yeah, the book is brilliant. Peter is truly one of the smartest people I've ever met in my entire life, if not the smartest. But he's also just, it's not just his, it's not like the raw horsepower of his intelligence. It's also the creativity and the dynamic nature of his intelligence. I've never, ever been able to just have a conversation with him on autopilot. It is like he takes you to strange places and you have to, and you have to think of new things. And he's just a really incredible person. Incredible mind. And I think of that period of my life. So I did, I came out to San Francisco, I worked on those things. And that was sort of my, I think that was the first real education I ever had. It was hard. I was learning new things. There were huge concepts that no one else was talking about. So they were sort of alien. And I had to just, you know, think for myself and become a stronger thinker. And then, yeah, through that, at the end of that, it was like, that was essentially a sort of a branding project. I was working on a kind of a networking project with him as well. It was a summit we were throwing at Founders Fund. And that ultimately became my role at Founders Fund, is doing branding type stuff and networking type stuff, which is funny because it's sort of what I volunteered to do for the Seasteading Institute 10 years ago. And I wound up making a career out of it.
So I want to get into what Founders Fund does in just a second, but I do want to delve into this a little bit more, this introduction that you had to Peter Thiel, because it's really interesting to me, and it might be interesting to young people who are, you know, trying to get into tech or, you know, the VC world. And I've heard that Thiel he's remarkably open to this kind of thing. If you approach him with a good idea or just kind of an interesting mind, he's probably one of the most fascinating figures alive to me. And I just wonder, what is he like on a personal and professional level?
So Peter is genuinely always looking for new ideas. He is only interested in a conversation when he is learning something. And I think it's like the mistake a lot of people make when they talk to Peter is they want to tell him a bunch of stuff that he's already said. They want to express how much they agree with him on things. And they want to talk about, you know, indeterminate optimism and luck versus planning and all these things from the book. But it's like, yeah, he already knows that. He wrote it literally. So it's not, he likes bizarre, and by bizarre, I mean just really unpredictable stuff he's not heard of, people who have ideas that are, I guess I always say, strange views strongly held, like the weirdest stuff you can think of. Stuff I've been embarrassed. I remember early on when I just was getting to know him, we were at this like drinks thing, and this guy started peppering me with questions about lucid dreaming, which I have a weird interest in, and I have a whole journey in lucid dreaming. And Peter happened to like walk over and get caught in that conversation. And again, I didn't really know him that well back then, and I was sort of embarrassed. I'm like, oh God, I have to tell this. I have to now. I'm like midway through this conversation about waking up inside of my dreams and creating my own weird like personal assistant in the dream world. It's like weird stuff, and yeah. I'm like just sweating. I'm like, oh God, what is he gonna think about me? And at the end of it, he was like, wow, that was really interesting. Thanks for sharing that. And he meant it. You could see in his eyes. He was like, he found it truly interesting. He didn't know anything about lucid dreaming. He was just glad that I was sharing this bizarre thing he'd never thought of before. And I mean, that wasn't how we became friends. That was just, I think, one of the moments early on that I realized, like, I could just be myself around him. Not only could I just be myself, it was why we were friends. It was because it wasn't because of, you know, me agreeing with him on this or that. It was because he thought that I saw things differently than other people did. And by that, I mean like thinking uniquely. People always talk in this world about, in our culture at least, in the Western culture, we talk a lot about thinking for yourself. I think Peter's whole thing is like, yeah, we say it, but most people don't do it. And it sounds almost trite to say it out loud because we all are like, we're looking for unique thinkers. But I think a lot of the ways that we peacock unique thought is, I mean, I think at the most basic level, it starts when you're in like seventh, eighth grade and you're shopping at a Hot Topic. And now it's like you're peacocking social justice memes on Twitter. And it's like, well, so is everybody else. So it's not edgy, actually. You're just participating in our culture. What is the real counterculture? That's what he's interested in. And that's also, I mean, that's what I'm interested in as well.
And I know that it was reported that he moved out of Silicon Valley and to Los Angeles recently, which is where we happen to be based. But he, in some interviews, implied that there was a kind of oppressive groupthink going on in Silicon Valley right now. What is your impression of all that? Is there a little bit of a bubble or is that a little bit overstated?
There's always been a bubble because the technology industry is very small. And so there tends to be a lot of groupthink, at least as far as, you know what, I can only speak for my history with the industry. And that's been about, I would say, 8 years at this point. There's been quite a bit of groupthink. But when I moved here 8 years ago, it was all technology based. People were really obsessed with like new social media applications and like very silly solves to problems that no one actually had. And they were talking about technology, just not really useful technology. And so the contrarian thing to do back then was to talk about meaningful technology. And we were like, oh, like we're going to talk about real technology. You're talking about fake technology. We're going to talk about real technology. We're going to talk about innovation in, you know, rocketry and biology and artificial intelligence. But today, people aren't even talking about technology. Now it's all, people are consumed with politics. They're consumed with political correctness. I think Peter is totally right. It is this really oppressive echo chamber that you get most of your exposure to online, but that's where we live now. That's where most people spend most of their time is on the internet. So that feels extremely oppressive. And I'm working at a place where, you know, not only is it are we encouraged to speak our minds, but it's sort of expected that we should be unique. We should not be like other people. We should be expressing something genuinely new and different, and we should be fearless and things like that. I'm very lucky, and that's a privilege that I actually believe in. But I think it's a totally different situation for someone who's working at Google or Facebook. Or Uber or something like this, where there are these really oppressive HR policing type people who won't allow you to use certain very common words, phrases, like ways of, I think at Google, you can't use like war metaphors, or even things, you can't say things along the lines of, oh, we're killing these metrics or whatever. It's like very weird. And I think it kind of permeates everything. People are scared to talk. Most people, I don't think, believe in that stuff, but most people are scared enough of it that it creates this kind of cloud of silence, I guess.
How did that happen? Is it that, you know, Silicon Valley is viewed by the rest of the world, I would say, as a progressive place, and I mean that in just the broadest sense of, you know, they're the ones thinking about the future and forward looking. And so I imagine they might say that, you know, well, this is the future, is having this heightened level of sensitivity. Is that where this is coming from? Or what's your read of the genesis of all that?
No, I don't think any of it was architected. I think it has happened just sort of by accident. I think a lot of it has to do with just, it's the nature of the internet. Polarizing content is propelled forward, and moderated content is just sort of like calm, measured, reasonable content is lost. And we are, I think, more than anyone else in the world, this is the highest density of people who are online a lot. And we're kind of leaders in that way. Like, it started here because we were spending so much time communicating with each other on these platforms. And I mean, you see this kind of groupthink in journalism as well. Yeah. And they have similar media habits as people in our industry. I think that.
So you're saying that this Excel, because yes, you're right. We are seeing this permeate throughout the wider culture now, and it was just accelerated in this industry because these are the people who were the first early adopters of the technology.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, that's what I think. I mean, there are other things as well. Like, yes, this is a very progressive place. This is, I mean, we're in San Francisco now, is effectively the capital of the technology industry. And this has always been a really liberal place. But I mean, the people who are moving here are not, they're not hippies, right? It's like a new, it's basically well-educated, upwardly mobile Americans, Indians, there's immigration from China to a certain extent, but it's like the far leftist stuff it's like something new. It's like your college professor's wokeness mm-hmm. metastasized, and it's like it accounts for maybe 1% of the people out here. 1 out of 100 people are that crazy, but they're so loud that the rest of the people are like, I'm just not going to say anything. Or maybe they kind of somewhat agree, but they also somewhat disagree, and it's just not worth it for them.
Yeah.
So I don't know that like the whole culture is that. It's just that the culture is a culture of not speaking up for yourself.
Yeah, I want to loop back to this near the end. We can talk about maybe solutions that you all are thinking about to kind of reboot the internet. But I think this is a natural place to get into what Founders Fund does, because like you said, you know, your whole group is kind of about thinking differently, being a little contrarian, going against the groupthink. And Founders Fund seems to be founded in that spirit. And in fact, there's a manifesto up on the site that basically says venture capital was broken or stagnant. And I'm curious if you could expand on that a little bit. Tell me, what is the underlying philosophy of Founders Fund, and how do you position yourselves as different from the typical venture capital fund, and what went wrong, I guess, in your mind with venture capital?
Right. So that manifesto was written, I think, almost 9 years ago now. It was right around the time we raised Fund 4. So we went from our third fund, we'd raised like $125 million around that. Fund 4, we raised $625. So it was a huge difference. We were changing a lot at that point. We went from a smaller sort of earlier stage venture capital firm to a fund that invested in all stages of a company's funding life, and also all sectors. We became sector agnostic. But at that time, everyone in Silicon Valley was focused on trying to find the next Mark Zuckerberg. And it's like, well, we already found Mark Zuckerberg. We don't need to find another one. He is Mark Zuckerberg. Facebook, we were heavily invested in Facebook. It was like, how do we get away from that? That was groupthink back then. I kind of alluded to it a bit before. The groupthink of Silicon Valley 10 years ago was like, it was not political at all. It was, people were focused on just the hottest new useless company. There were so many just like really silly things that people were spending their time on, raising a bunch of money for stuff that just wasn't valuable at all. And we were like, well, there's all this really hard stuff that no one's working on.
And it kind of became a joke a couple years ago when Uber blew up. There was like, it was, the line was just, this is Uber for fill in the blank. So it's,
right.
Yeah.
That became new. So yeah, when I started, it was like, this is Facebook for whatever, or right. This is Google for whatever. And it's like, it's always, that's correct. You're correct. It's always that. It's always, once people are obsessed with using some other company to describe their company, it's like, that's not original. We're now in a sort of swamp of people not thinking for themselves, people not creating things that are genuinely new. So we went out looking for new things. And a way that you could do that is to look for frontiers. There were all of these technology and science frontiers, places where people were really scared to make bets. We made one of the largest bets in bio out of a company. So for a VC firm like ours, so we were associated with sort of internet technology. And those VC firms are not known for making bio investments. You know, that's a world that is sort of dominated by all these sort of big old bio VCs out in Boston. But we dipped in with our Stemcentrics investment. That was a huge deal. SpaceX, people laughed about that investment. Literally, people stood up at their annual meeting and talked about us as if we were crazy and said things like, don't worry, we're never going to be investing in rocket ships. And it's like, okay, well, back then when we wrote that manifesto, that's all we wanted to invest in. Like really, really fringe, crazy technologies that no one else was working on that had huge potential. So things like DeepMind, artificial intelligence, SpaceX, rocketry, Stemcentrics and biology, all that kind of stuff. Palantir actually was pretty much incubated at a founder's fund through Peter. He was a co-founder. That was a really, really hard data company. I think the big insight in data was like back in the day, everyone was obsessed with data. We need more data, more data, more data. It was like, okay, well, we have all this data and no way to make sense of any of it. What we actually need is a way to make sense of the data. But that was going to be a really complicated multi-year journey. And we, made the bet. We're like, yeah, let's take that journey. But that was back then. Like I said, I think that as we became more and more successful and our thesis proved to be true, there was all of this stuff kind of on these different frontiers that was being overlooked. And our brand just became more elevated. People started to copy it, to be honest, the brand, not the, you can't copy the way that we invest, but you can copy the brand. So the idea of like, the moonshots and like the rocketry and the crazy like AI stuff, the sort of science fiction in real life branding, that has become much more ubiquitous in Silicon Valley, which is dangerous for the technology, I think. I think once you get a bunch of groupthink into a space like that, valuations spike, first of all. But with that, what you have is a lot of stuff that costs a lot of money, but it's really hard to tell the signal from the noise. Once a brand like once the science fiction in real life, as the science fiction in real life stuff is heated up, it's like there are a lot of people who have a lot to gain by pretending to be that, even if they're not. You saw this in most recently. You saw this with the ICOs and all the sort of cryptocurrency stuff. And back in 2008, you saw it with green startups, all of the environmental stuff. So once something becomes really, really popular, you get this proliferation of companies pretending to be that thing. And it's like, it's just hard to make investments in that space.
And so how does Founders Fund sift through all of the signal all the noise to find the signal? What's your strategy?
So everyone on the team is a little bit different. Everyone here has their own strategy. They have their own ways of going. They have their own ways of going about things. They have their own networks, sort of slightly unique networks, each of them. But I would say probably the common theme is founder focus, first of all, and then someone who's genuinely doing something new and maybe a little bit dangerous sounding. I mean, if you're out there just competing for the hottest deal, it's like one, you're going to overpay, and then two, you're just not really thinking about it. Once you're competing with someone for the deal and there's like this hot sort of like everyone's bidding basically, you just get caught up in the competition of that and you're not actually wondering if the deal is good or not. So you want to find just like differentiated deal flow. You can do that through your network. A lot of our friends who have started companies who are very successful now, so like our most successful founders themselves begin angel investing. They're tracking their friends and they tend to send us deals because we have pretty good, I would say great relationships with all of our founders. So they always keep really close contact with us. They're sending us deals. Our founders are out there. Our partners are out there, like I said, with their own deal flow. And it's mostly, it's really a networking game, I would say. That's probably all VC.
What is, I want to dig into some of the sectors that you're investing in. We mentioned SpaceX, which most people know about. You mentioned biology earlier, biotechnology. What are some of the most exciting developments or promising developments in that field right now, do you think?
Wait, in which field?
Oh, biotechnology.
Oh, okay. In bio. Yeah. So I think that this is just my belief. It's not a founder's fund belief. This is my belief. I think that bio is the most interesting thing happening right now.
Why is that?
So in the early 2000s, cracked the human genome, the human genome is cracked. And there was this sense that once that happened, we would have all of these cures to these diseases. We would know everything about the human body. We would just be like rewriting ourselves. It would be amazing. It's going to be this utopia. And people, as the Genome Project, as we were working on the Human Genome Project throughout the 90s, I mean, people would talk about this as just like the most important, the holy grail. And then we cracked it and nothing really happened. And the reason nothing happened is it was another data problem. We had so much data, but we had no way of making sense of the data. Increasingly, what we're seeing now in an age of machine learning is people are much better at making sense of the data, and that is being paired with better tools for cutting. So that's what CRISPR is. CRISPR is one tool for cutting. There are many. CRISPR is a very good one. So as we see better tools for cutting, and as we're gathering more information on what our genes do, we are entering a world where we're going to be able to basically become, I think, whatever we want. It's not going to maybe start with this sort of biological self-determination where we're really editing ourselves and our children and all of this. I think it's going to start with you're going to see solutions and people are going to be editing algae to do things for us. We're going to be building biological factories. We're going to have new sources of power. We're going to have much more efficient foods. I think hunger is going to be eliminated. And I think we are going to see gene therapies for a lot of things. Off the top of my head, cystic fibrosis is like, I think that we can cure that. I think that there's almost no reason. It's one gene. There's no reason we shouldn't be able to cure that before the germline, but then also with gene therapies, if in a mature adult, there should be cures there. There's a whole list of these things. They're they're called knockout genes.
Right.
A gene where if you just get rid of one thing, a whole disease is cured. I think there's going to be a whole crop of stuff like that. It's coming.
Do you anticipate?
I really believe it's coming.
Do you anticipate much regulatory pushback or problems, you know, getting around the FDA and so forth? I mean, we saw, for instance, that there was a kind of unregulated knockout gene performed on some embryos in China, and to knock out a gene that perhaps will make the baby immune to HIV, and it caused a huge controversy.
Well, what they actually did was, I believe they added a gene, I think they added a mutation that made the children immune to or resistant to HIV. And
using CRISPR,
mm-hmm. But that kind of stuff, well, first of all, I'm in favor of that long term. I love mm-hmm. that. I think that we should be doing that all the time. I think the whole future is going to be that. There's absolutely no reason that we should be okay, that we should just be sitting with HIV and malaria and cancer. Eventually, there are all these genes that these would be knockout genes. If you carry a certain certain gene that make you much more likely to get breast cancer, for example, or things like this, we should just eliminate them. Get them out of here. There's no reason to have them. I think the FDA, it's a mixed bag. So I've never worked with the FDA. I'm not a founder of a biotechnology startup. I will say that I was surprised to find that most of the, so this is, you know, this information is maybe not that useful. It's just my experience with founders. It's kind of anecdotal. But from what I've heard, I was surprised to find that people are mixed. Like a lot of people are sort of okay with the FDA, especially under Trump. Like, I mean, he's been crazy in a lot of dimensions, but not on this. The FDA is much better under Trump than it was previously. Much more interested in getting drugs to market, and I think much less concerned with being overly cautious and concerned with image and things like this.
Right.
So that's cool. That's a sort of development, a positive development. Yeah, people are somewhat frustrated with certain things and somewhat not with others. I don't think the FDA is really the big problem here. The FDA is always just going to mirror culture to a certain extent. They're actually bolder than our culture is almost always. The problem is always going to be our culture, how we think about these things. That's a big part of the reason that I set out to work on Anatomy of Next, our podcast. I wanted to sort of myth bust all of our fears about technology and science and show people a world that could be with this stuff. If we actually sat down and planned out the perfect world, what would that look like?
Yeah, let's talk about the podcast a little bit, because yeah, as I mentioned, it's a very interesting project. I recommend it to anybody who is into this stuff, because you look at what you do is you in the second season, for instance, you imagine what would it take to build a colony on Mars, and then you bring in actual experts in these various sectors to talk about, you know, constructing a new city. How would you feed people? How would people reproduce? I wonder. First of all, the framing of building a colony on Mars. Why did you choose that? And why is that a frontier that you think is worth thinking about? Because most people, I think, are pretty, you know, it's pretty comfortable here on Earth, and Mars seems like kind of a hellscape that no one would want to leave for. So, but why, in your mind, is that still is that worth you know, getting into the popular imagination?
Right. So Mars is a hellscape for sure. It actually is a terrible place to live right now. It's like worse than Mad Max. No atmosphere, no water. It's freezing cold, highly radiated. Gravity is not great. It's better than the moon, but still not great. What's amazing, what's exciting to me about Mars is the fact that we have the technology to change almost all of those things. So backing up just a second, Anatomy of Next started out.
The blank slate is the appeal of it.
It's not just any. So the moon is also sort of a blank slate, but Mars has all of the raw material we need to build an actual sort of Earth-like planet. People make arguments for the moon all the time, and also people make arguments for Venus. It's just it's way, way harder on both the moon and Venus for a lot of reasons that we don't have to get into now. But Mars is the way forward if we want. If you believe in any kind of potential for the human being in the stars, if like life, if you don't see life ending, and I mean all life, all known life, if you don't want it to end right here in this solar system on this one planet, then this is the next step. It's Mars. We have to go there, and we can't just go there. We actually have to make that world habitable for life. We have to apply all of the knowledge that we've learned for the past, you know, thousands of years to this one incredibly ambitious project that, in my opinion, it's like, no, do we need it to live right now, today, on this planet? Absolutely not. But to me, Mars is the reason that we live. It is like the purpose. It is our purpose. This is the direction. This is what makes us good. I think that it's like representative. You asked why I chose this for this season. I think it's also sort of a metaphor. It's a metaphor for human potential. The idea that we can build worlds, like, that's just, to me, self-evidently incredible. And I think, though, it comes down to just these two speeds you have. Like, either you think life is worth protecting, or you think it's just totally random and not much of anything, like a blip in the cosmos, and who cares? That might sound unfair, but I've actually met many people who believe that. Mm-hmm. It's the truth. It's like an extremely academic opinion. The idea that nothing really matters. It's super nihilistic, but that's common now, and it's not what I believe in. This is a podcast. Anatomy of Next is a podcast for people who believe in human potential, who believe that we're good, who believe that we belong in the stars, who have a greater ambition for us. And I think that you know, the humanists will ask, well, what about Earth? Perfectly valid question. I also care about Earth. NASA's budget is like less than 1% of the entire US budget. And we have enough money already to get to Mars if we just put a plan together to do it. So like, that's not the problem. We're putting most of our resources towards Earth, and that's great. But also technology that we deploy on Mars and new technology we'll have to create to tackle the problems of Mars, that's going to have a downstream effect. It'll have massive benefits on Earth. Things like genetically engineering crops to use less nitrogen on the planet Mars, for example. I mean, that's a huge problem that we also have here on Earth. That's going to have an effect that could end all hunger, all human hunger, all of it could be gone. We started out the show in season one. It's currently down. I'm going to put it back up in a few weeks. But season one was really just this look at the dystopian way that we talk about technology, especially in Hollywood. And I wanted to kind of myth bust that and talk about what the sort of great, what was the sort of utopian version of biotechnology, right? We know the dystopian version. It's Jurassic Park, it's Gattaca. We know that, but there's never really been a positive story. What does that look like? Why are so many people working on this stuff? So I wanted to do that. But one thing that came up again and again among technologists, scientists, entrepreneurs, was space. So that was the one that they were all really hopeful for. And I think that in space, that is a place where optimistic, hopeful people meet. The people who believe in people, they all sort of agree on this. It's almost a faith. I think it's a faith in us and in people. And that was this binding glue I felt between all of the people who I cared about in the technology community. And so I wanted to tell that story. I set out thinking, and I've been interested in this topic since I was a little kid, like I mentioned earlier. And I set out thinking really like, I mean, this is inevitable. There's got to be people who are working on this stuff already. The unfortunate truth is that most people are not working on this stuff. I found a lot of experts who had expertise that could help me in kind of weaving the story together. But there is no plan, certainly not from NASA, certainly not from any other government. I think China just announced it's going in like 2050 or something, which means they don't have a plan to get there because it doesn't take that long to get to Mars. You could get to Mars. You start planning now, I think it's reasonable within 10 years we would be there. But we're always saying the Mars plan is going to happen in 10 years. We've been saying that for 50 years. So I just don't see, there's no evidence for this. And that is concerning to me. We can do it. We can really do it. We have the technology to do it. But I think that our culture it feels stagnant to me. It feels disenchanted. It feels self-critical in a way that I think is to a certain degree is healthy. Like maybe you want to be like 5% self-critical. I think we're 50% self-critical, and I think it just feels like we're in a really unhealthy place.
And space is in the past been pretty much exclusively the domain of governments. I mean, it started kind of as a Cold War project. Now things are changing with companies like SpaceX getting involved, and actually a lot of the sectors that you're getting involved in, energy, biotech to some degree, have traditionally been, a lot of heavy government involvement. And with SpaceX, you're still, contracting with the government. But what is the role of the private sector in this? And how do you think that is going to change the entire equation when it comes to something, for instance, like space exploration?
Right. So the space industry is always the thing that I've had the hardest time reconciling with my libertarianism.
Yeah.
I've
heard that from a lot of people, actually. So
I look at what our government did during Apollo, and I'm proud. I'm so proud of us. I think it was amazing, and I think it is undeniable that that was a good use of government resources and planning. They planned that. That was a hard thing to do. They weren't just sort of throwing money to a bunch of nonprofits and saying, figure it out, and hoping for the best. Like, that was pretty much what our green strategy was in the 2000s. It was this really ambitious project that they planned out, they executed, and it's, you know, one of the greatest human achievements of all time. I think it is the greatest human achievement of all time. But going forward, it's like, we no longer have an existential threat in the Soviet Union, which was a motivation for us to go to the moon. I think maybe the greatest motivation. We like to kind of look back. I would love to believe that all humans agreed that, in sort of my take on things, that this is important because people are important, because life is important, but I don't think that's true. I think what motivated us was a fear of Russian nuclear bombs on the moon, and that's what got us up there first. And I think that without that motivation, it's going to be very, very hard to get people interested in Mars. So this is where Elon has come in. You know, he's just trying to make the cost of getting there so cheap that the optimistic human spirit stuff is enough to get us there. Like, well, if it's, you know, 1/1000th of the cost it was 10 years ago, then it's almost inevitable that we'll get there. We definitely have enough will to get there under those circumstances. I think the private-public partnership in the future is looking to be something like, the private industry is going to be making this a lot more affordable. Certainly Elon is doing this. And I think he's actually just, I mean, SpaceX is going to be the main, that's going to be the main company that does this. And hopefully the government will get its shit together and we will hire some people at NASA who are single-mindedly focused on getting us to Mars and using this amazing technology that people in the private industry are creating, because that's what we need. The private industry still needs a motive incentive. And that is, I think there is a motive incentive on Mars, but it's very long term. It's a much harder sell than it would be to the government, where there is room for this kind of thing, where we're like, well, if it's affordable, or, you know, reasonably affordable, more affordable than it was, is it just worth it for us as a species? Is it important? Is that important? And I think that's the path forward. I hope that's the path forward, because I don't really see another path forward. I don't see the private industry doing it alone, and I don't see the government inventing anything that's going to get us there.
And you hosted on your podcast, there was a panel that was talking about some of these public-private partnerships, and it seemed that the nature of that relationship is changing somewhat, possibly for the better, in that it's becoming more efficient, as opposed to the past, you know, compared to, say, World War II, where there was almost like a government takeover of industry. Now there's something else going on. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Certainly. So a lot of our companies work very closely with the government. SpaceX, Palantir, now Anduril, all have great relationships with the feds. They're a huge customer. They're an important customer. This is this whole trend that we're all excited about at Founders Fund, which is, you know, the government really just kind of giving away certain things that it manages poorly to the private industry, who manages them much better. So Palantir will be intelligence, SpaceX, obviously rocketry, and now Anduril defense technology. But I don't know what the future looks like with this stuff, because the future of our relationship with the government is determined entirely by the government in power. And the government in power right now is completely consumed with a hatred of the technology industry that has never before been this bad. You have people on the right who are justifiably upset with social media companies who are censoring their speech. So they're like not willing to support the technology industry in the way they might have once supported the technology industry from the left, which in its newest incarnation seems pretty almost religiously committed to the destruction of wealth, which they see as centralized in San Francisco. I think they're just looking to scapegoat someone for their own failures. And so here we are with two parties willing to just screw this industry, which in my opinion is the only thing that is really keeping this country relevant. And I'm really nervous about that. And this, again, this is like another cultural problem that now is informing our political system. And That's going to have an impact on the partnership stuff. And I think certainly defense is going to be great. All the Palantir and SpaceX stuff, that's going to work out. It's like they're doing that. Those partnerships are there. They're very fruitful. It's like more about what we're going to be missing out on that we never even knew we could have had. It's like the stuff, it's the companies that would have come up in a few years. Those are the companies that I'm worried about.
When I see the tension that seems to be there between Silicon Valley and Washington, D.C., a lot of it from the outside seems like it's a power struggle, because Silicon Valley and the technology companies are holding an increasing amount of information. They control to some degree what people see and hear, and obviously a lot of money. So is there a sense in which the politicians in DC are right to be afraid that the power is shifting?
I think that they are certainly, I feel like they're accidentally right. I think that there is a huge concentration of wealth and now power in Silicon Valley. But the left is sort of so misguided on what they're even criticizing right now that in my mind, they're just like almost irrelevant. It's like, it's just like this crazy populist rage that has not, it's like not based in the actual landscape. I think the right is a little closer to the truth on this one. I think that the censorship stuff is real. I think that the platforms on which we're interacting with the world are completely dominated by a few people, really, a few sort of tech oligarchs who all think the same. And I think the right should be nervous about that. We should all be nervous about that.
Is there any way that any path that you see out of that beyond? I mean, you hear rumblings from actually both the left and right of antitrust legislation, but is there a more market-based solution to that, a kind of Internet 3.0 or something of that nature that people at Founders Fund are thinking about?
Well, so right now, the technology companies are protected by legislation that basically doesn't hold them accountable for crime that happens on or that is organized on their platform. In the same way, you wouldn't, you could not go after a phone company because a couple of people organized, terrorist attack or something using the network. Facebook isn't held accountable for that either. Twitter's not held accountable for that. Google's not held accountable for that on Gmail or whatever. And I think the market-based solution here would be saying it's all or nothing. If you want those protections, you have to have completely free speech on the platform. If the speech is legal in the US, it should be legal on the platform. And I think that solves a lot of the problem.
So are you talking about Section 230, the liability protections?
Mm-hmm, I am.
Right. Okay. And what about there's various projects to create kind of decentralized platforms. Do you see any potential there, or is that not really going to
people
do
want
much?
That people yeah. just really people really 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 want that to work, so they're really optimistic about it. I am super skeptical of it. I want to believe that it's possible, but I don't believe that it is.
Why is that? Just that it's not an optimal user experience?
It's all about, for me, it's like the value of networks is just so insane. And let's just talk about Twitter for a minute. no one is leaving Twitter to go onto any of these other services except one certain kind of person. So they're going to be basically anarcho-capitalists who hold a lot of Bitcoin. They're going to be the first people onto this platform. It's going to become a platform synonymous with those people, and no one else is going to want to join. You know, that sounds like a fun time to me, but that's not a fun time to any of the journalists or actors or celebrities who make Twitter pop for the wider population. It's just not going to I just don't see it happening.
Yeah, we've seen this happen on a different level with something Gab. Like Gab, where it's a bunch of kind of right-wing trolls who get kicked off and then go on Gab, and then it's just...
Well, and actual racists. Like, so the worst, the things that everyone is sort of called that are not... So everyone calls, you know, Twitter's always, like, on Twitter, it's like you don't like someone, you call them a Nazi or whatever.
Yeah.
I think like there are some Nazis on Gab. Like I think that that's what happened is like that became the place where it was okay to be extremely I don't even know if you would call that the right. It's some other just like race nationalism type stuff and also trolls and some people on the right, but like generally no, it's just this toxic waste dump that no one wants to be a part of. And that's always going to happen to some degree when the people who are upset are all the same. Like we're hearing a lot from the IDW now about creating a new social network, and I hope that happens. I would love to see that. But if the first people on that network are all thinking the same, then you're never going to get anybody else there. Like Twitter started out very, very general. It was a general audience. I remember using it just for like funny jokes. That's where it was not political back in the day, barely. It was a place where really everyone felt they could just go and talk about funny stuff and tweet about nonsense, share some articles to whatever. And then gradually it just sort of metastasized into this like political hellstorm that it is today.
There's you mentioned a couple times one of Founders Fund's big investments, Palantir, which is just last year, the Wall Street Journal was estimating that it could go public with a $41 billion IPO. And this is a intelligence service. It helps it helps the national intelligence agencies sort through the massive amounts of data and better recognize patterns. Some journalists have actually hinted that Palantir may have helped lead to capturing Osama bin Laden. From a libertarian perspective, you know, some people are concerned. In fact, I even made a video just posing the question, is Silicon Valley building the tools for a surveillance state? How do you balance those concerns, this need for national security and, you know, the great results you can get from, you know, private industry making things more efficient and the broader libertarian concerns?
Oh, man, it's such a good question. I wish I had a good answer for you. I think it's just complicated and it's just, so I guess at the most basic level, it's like, who do you want to be working on this stuff? Like the government or a bunch of libertarian-minded engineers who are committed to civil liberties and things like this. I am happier that it's in our hands than it is in theirs.
Right.
I understand that that's not really a morally defensible position. I am glad to live in a world with Palantir. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no. So you're saying that this is an inevitable. The government, you know, is going to be collecting.
Well, not even just our government. I'm saying, and not just collecting. So the Chinese government, the Russian government, like these are the governments that you have to worry about. Our government is basically, I mean, incompetent. I'm not scared of our government. I'm scared of the. I'm scared of the Chinese government. And if it's like, if it's a choice between us, and it is, it actually is. It's like it literally is a choice between us or them. I want it to be us. It's like it's the story of the atom bomb all over again. I don't want Nazi Germany to have the atom bomb. I want it to be a country that at least thinks about these questions and has conversations like this and acknowledges that this is a morally complicated area. I think it's, yeah, it's hard, but this is where I think that we need to be working on this stuff. Not only because there are all these great things about it, but because it's like other people are also working on this stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, China is, pouring many resources into, for instance, artificial intelligence. And I believe a study just came out indicating that more kind of publications came out of China on that topic than the United States. And on your podcast, you had on a gentleman named Kai-Fu Lee, a Taiwanese venture yeah. capitalist, to talk about China. And the sense I got from that was that, you know, this is a country full of hungry entrepreneurs that are just willing to work as hard as they need to get ahead. And that, you know, in some sense, they're going to eat our lunch when it comes to scaling up some of the next great technological breakthroughs. So, I mean, what's your perspective, particularly on China and the future?
I think that China right now is very good at, you mentioned scaling. They're very good at scaling technologies that we've created ourselves in the US and to a certain extent in Europe. Like all the AI algorithms that they're using have come from here or Europe, mostly from here. That having been said, there's no reason to believe that China will just always be stealing our stuff. Like they have an incentive to be producing their own things. I think it's inevitable that they will. Certainly they're working on things in secret that we don't know about. We have a huge open source culture here, and that's where the Chinese have gotten a lot of our technology. Is just like, we're publishing it out into the open, and they're like, great, we're going to take it and we're actually going to use it. Cause a lot of the stuff that we build here or we invent here, we're like too afraid to use, or for whatever, sort of historical reason, it doesn't make sense to use here. For example, payments, mobile payments are huge, in China, sort of like, I'm talking about like out in the street, like they don't have credit cards. They use mobile. It's better in a lot of ways than a credit card, but China didn't have that infrastructure until, so like recently now there's a reason for credit. Like the economy is doing well in China and all of this. And there's this better sort of superior technology and they can just use that instead. We've had a healthy economy for, you know, centuries. And in a lot of ways now it's harder to get away from that legacy infrastructure. So we're at a disadvantage there. But yeah, the future of China is going to be they're just going to use everything that we've created and they're going to scale it up really fast. And then the proof of their entrepreneurial potential is going to come when they actually start competing with our companies head on in new markets. And I don't know what that's going to look like. The Chinese are very, very, very confident that they're just going to sort of obliterate us. There's no evidence for this at all. We'll see. Certainly Europe is irrelevant at this point. They have especially in artificial intelligence, like that comes down to the data sets you have. So China has another edge here in that they have, you know, the government's collecting all this information and just working with their companies. It is better to be a free country, but it's also harder in all these places. Like it's harder to win a war in World War II when you're facing a country that doesn't have any of the qualms that we do. And in fact, even we've made all sorts of, I would say, I don't want to say moral sacrifices, but certainly we've done things that are in war that are morally ambiguous, not great. And what am I trying to say here? Sorry, I'm losing my train of thought. I think that we're going to be playing at a disadvantage, and yet I'm optimistic. I think when it comes to creativity, imagination, and also just like a will to become something, I think the individual spirit of the Americans is our greatest power, and the Chinese aren't trying to scale that. So yeah, I think, I don't know, despite everything, I still think we're going to do fine.
I think that a lot of people are observing the rise of China and their, you know, authoritarian system, and then it's in some ways feeding into some of the politics we're starting to see here in the United States, where there's been a sharp turn against markets and capitalism in recent years. Obviously, there's been the rise of Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on the left, and to some extent, Trumpism on the right, I would say. And the entire Founders Fund project is really premised on the idea that, that capitalism is the driver of innovation that's going to make life better for all of humanity. So how would you defend that proposition to people who are looking at someone like Bernie Sanders and thinking, you know, there is a lot of inequality and unfairness in the world, and he makes a lot of sense?
I would say that, so first of all, I think that the comparison of capitalism to socialism is fallacious. They're totally different things. Capitalism is, I equate it with freedom. It is like man in his natural state is a capitalist. People are going to be in a forest in the middle of nowhere. You can plant a plant, you grow it, it's yours. Someone comes over, they want it. You were willing to trade with them for something. So like free exchange, it emerged very early on. It's just like how we think. Even other species exhibit certain capitalistic tendencies. And by capitalistic, I mean the idea of private property and exchange and sort of now a medium of exchange. That's the real innovation, money. It's the air that we breathe. It's oxygen. Socialism is a prescription for force. It's a government. Capitalism is not a government. Capitalism can exist under many different kinds of governments. There's a certain degree of capitalism in China. It's a very different government than the government that we have in the United States. People want to talk about the Scandinavian countries as socialist. It's insane. They're not socialist. They're definitely capitalist. There's no Scandinavian who's going to tell you that their countries are socialist countries. They have free exchange. They have private property. Their government protects those rights. And also, while we're talking about it, like the taxes that are raised in Scandinavia are on par with the taxes that are raised in California. The Scandinavians are just much better at government than we are. Our government is not as efficient. That's why we don't have things like the healthcare system that they have in Scandinavia or whatnot. So I would say that to the Bernie Sanders supporter, the person who's like sort of just oblivious of the rest of the world, oblivious of the real system that Scandinavians have, oblivious of what's happening in Venezuela, oblivious of history, sure. So they've not listened to any of those things. Let's just do a sort of like logical thought experiment. To live in a system of total equality, so to say that all industry is owned by everyone, it's owned by the government, it's owned by all of us. So the way that manifests is you need a government to own it on behalf of everybody and to manage it. And the way that you do that is you have a vote. Like, how do you pick who's going to determine what for our resources, right? So you have a vote. It's democratic. So the idea of democratic socialism is something Ocasio keeps making this difference. She's like, it's not socialism, it's democratic socialism. Okay, we'll open a history book. All socialism is democratic. It all starts out democratic. The problem is, under a socialist system, you lose the incentive to produce. It doesn't completely vanish. I don't believe that people just stop working completely, but it is undeniable that people, their major incentive is to take care of themselves and their family members, the people who are closest to them. Okay, so that's who they want to work for. Under a socialist system, when you're working for everybody and everything you're producing is being taken away from you on behalf of everybody and then being sort of given out to people centrally, you're just going to work a little bit less hard. You're not going to work as hard. And that is, we've seen that in every single socialist government in history. As that productivity declines, the country starts to starve. And the only way you can get someone to work under a system like that with no incentive to produce is to compel them to produce. It's basically slavery. You have to enslave people. And in a democratic system, it's really hard to get people to vote for their own enslavement. So naturally what happens is the person you elected in democratically becomes a dictator. Okay, the votes are canceled. On behalf of democracy, there can be no democracy. And so every single democratic socialist state tends invariably towards this state of just total, horrific, starving slavery. And you can say, well, that's not what we're asking for. We're asking just for like universal healthcare. And so I would say, then just ask for that. Then ask for that. Okay, that's, you're asking for the socialization of an industry, perhaps, but ask for that instead of socialism. Because my big question, not to the people who are voting for socialism because they want these things, and they're right to a certain degree, like our healthcare system is horrible. We do need to fix it. I think that there are all sorts of free market fixes to it myself, but they're not wrong that there's a problem there. The problem I have is with socialists saying they're socialists now, our politicians saying it out loud, because my question is like, why are you calling for socialism and not universal healthcare? And the only reason that I can see is because they actually believe that socialism is morally good. They haven't gotten the message. They don't believe that it tends invariably towards slavery. They don't want just universal healthcare. They want universal everything they do. That's the ambition. There are socialists running on those platforms throughout Europe. In those countries like Scandinavia, there are people running on platforms of more government control, whole industries being nationalized. Like, there's always someone standing up and asking for that. And so I think you have to just be realistic. I think we have to be realistic and kind of just, you know, Ocasio says she's a socialist and we should just say, okay, I believe you. That's horrific. And we should do everything in our power to stop you.
You mentioned that you have this sense that there's a kind of malaise, a self-critical kind of feeling that is permeating American culture right now. And Peter Thiel in the past has told economist Tyler Cowen that there was a stagnation in the world of atoms, not bits, meaning that all our innovations were, you know, online and not in the physical world, which is what you're trying to shift things towards. Do you see this turning around at all? And if not, what is needed to make it turn around? Or if it is turning around, what is needed to accelerate that innovation again?
Well, I think this is why people find Elon Musk and his work so inspiring, is because he's one of the few people who has really made incredible innovations in the world of matter, in atoms rather than bits. I think we have some examples of this. I think Palmer Luckey is someone who's doing a lot of work here with his work at Anduril right now. I think that there are these signs of this. I think throughout the biotechnology industry, again, you see a lot of this, a lot of innovation in the world of bits rather than bytes. Just the world of bio, I think, is using bytes to do that, to innovate in the world of bits. I think I'm maybe a little more optimistic than Peter is. I do see some stuff. And I think what's most exciting to me about the stuff that I see is that people are excited when they see it. I think the average person sees that rocket ship land and they're like, oh God, that's a leap forward in some way. That's the kind of thing that we need. That means something. And the innovation in the world of bytes meant something too. It's just like, you just can't have only that. I see some stuff. I think it's happening at a pretty slow pace, much slower than people realize. But my hope is that through things like Mars, you get people inspired again. People have a belief that there's something for them in the world.
And part of your project seems to be, as you mentioned, showing people that potential future, that to counter a lot of the dystopian attitude towards technology that is prevalent in our culture and in Hollywood. So I guess to close out, what is that rosier possibility of the future that you see? Like, what should people imagine and get excited about?
It's not my idea. It's a sort of, I would say it's not a common idea, but it's common among idealists. We should be working towards a world of post-scarcity, a world where we have unlimited energy, unlimited food, water, healthcare, education for everyone. I mean, this is the sort of utopian dream, the sort of utopian Star Trekian dream is to not have to worry about material constraints. That's the sort of first stage is getting that for everybody. And I think that really begins with, I think that begins with energy. I interviewed a young guy named Taylor Wilson once. He's the youngest person ever to create nuclear fusion in his basement, which he did, I believe at 14, unsustainable, of course, because it always is. But I mean, he did it. And he says that energy is the currency of the material world. I believe that. That's totally true. And we need to crack that egg. That'll be the first one. But once you have that, once you have post, once you're living in a world of post abundance, I think that we need something to believe in outside of us that becomes our purpose. And that's, for me, that's the stars. That's getting off of this planet and getting into the universe. If you care about life. So a lot of people don't care as much about human life, but they care about life generally. Even these people who are obsessed with Mother Earth, like this kind of religious Mother Earth Gaia hypothesis type stuff. If you care about life, then you should care about people, because people are the only things on this planet that can protect life long term. We're the only things on this planet that we know of that can take life into the universe. We're the only things that exist that can preserve life potentially indefinitely. And ultimately, I think reverse entropy. This is the natural human condition, is to like make order from chaos. The universe is unraveling, and we are this strange anomaly that can ravel things back up, that can place things back in order. I think that's our purpose. I think it's very big. It's very abstract. I know it's probably hard for all of us, including myself, to wrap our heads around, but that's, I see direction there. I see that as the path forward ultimately is entering the universe and maybe saving it from the heat death. That's it.
Michael Solana is a vice president of Founders Fund and host of the podcast Anatomy of Next. Thank you very much for talking to us, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Please remember to rate and review us on iTunes and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.